Okay, Cameron McEwen and Bob Dobbs are back for episode number 45. Now we had a little break there, and we're looking at page 82 of my book. And at the very top of my page 82, not necessarily Cameron's, we have the important quote about connubium of a superterrestrial kind. Well, that inspired Cameron to write an article or several articles on this theme, which you can get at his collection. Do you want to say concisely how to find it, Cameron?
How to find that particular post or how to find the blog?
No. Well, generally the blog and then the post.
Yeah, so the blog is called McEwen's New Sciences. So even if you just search Google McEwen Sciences, plural, it usually comes up on the first page. And then Connubium of Being is a recent post. And so when you go to the blog, it appears at the top on the right side. So it's very easy to find once you're at the blog.
Yeah, and this is a very original essay. Nobody has ever discussed the last page of War and Peace in the Global Village, page 190, and how McEwen talks about the macrocosmic connubium and variations of that. And I pointed that out to Cameron, and he took the ball and ran with it, which is really great. So it's a really important point, which then we wanted to get into the numbness factor that Cameron talks about in this article. But before we do that, we go down to 82, and we have the quote from page 190 in 190 of War and Peace in Gold Village. Then I say, Jean Baudrillard was on the appropriate angle when he said that he regarded McEwen as a musician. It might be more accurate to say that McEwen was a musician of the synesthete slash co-anesthete. See Don Thiel's Beyond the Word, 1995, for definitions. So I'll read that again. It might be more accurate to say that McEwen was a musician of the synesthete co-anesthete school. The only musical paramedia ecologist, that's my term, paramedia, but I'm getting para from Don Thiel, who recommended back in 71, as the word postmodern was starting to be used, he said it should be paramodern. No one took him up on it, but it's a good point. There's no post, actually, maybe just an overlaying. So you don't leave the modern, but you overlay it with something different from the modern, which people unfortunately call the postmodern, thinking there is a rupture, but we're still including everything in the big synchronicity, the big synchronous, big now, and so it would be paramodern, and then I adapted that to the paramedia ecologist. Now,
we should say that there's nothing wrong with distinction per se. It's just that if you think distinction so that you end up with a singularity, then you have a problem. You've tried to think distinction, but you, in effect, throw it away.
Yeah, and critics, as they became more aware of Finney's Wake and then McEwen, they always had difficulty of saying McEwen was a modernist or a postmodernist. They weren't sure. I think Croker calls him the last modernist. And Finnegan's Wake is obviously postmodern, because anybody who did postmodern works was influenced by Joyce, either Ulysses or Finnegan's Wake. So it's not correct to say Joyce is a modernist or from the modernist period. So that confusion, which probably is a paramodern situation, that you can't pin where the beginning stopped and the ending came in and the shifts of the discontinuity. That's the nature of the electric age.
Correct.
It's a paradox. There are distinctions, but then they're not. So you got two angles, depending on which sense bias you're using. So anyways, I say musical paramedia. Now, why I say paramedia, how I use it, is I bring in the use of mediums, psychics, seances, So that's paranormal. So on the surface, you don't know about Don's paramodern. You just see para, so the reader, the average reader, would think of paranormal. So I want that effect in my use of it, but it's not limited to that. But that's where I decided to adopt Don's term for these other reasons, right?
Yep.
So I say the only musical paramedia ecologist who was keeping up with McLuhan was Frank Zappa. This is why I put McLuhan Zappa in the holopathic television satellite quadrant of my tiny note chart. Let's see.
Yeah. So if people wanted to follow that up, the word in McLuhan that he uses when he's talking about this sort of stuff is paradox.
Paradox, yes. Yeah, para. Mm-hmm. Now, let's see. So then I have a little explanation. I go, the synesthete and co-anesthete aren't really musical. They're the TV images and interplay of many senses more than the movie. And it's live in quotes. People thought synesthesia was coming with TV, and that's why people took LSD to get the synthetic version of synesthesia mixing up their senses, which they already were getting from TV. Remember, synesthesia is one hears what one sees and sees what one hears. So the mixture of senses is what happened when people took LSD. But the other juxtaposition, co-anesthesia, is a tendency to put one, maybe I should say oneself, to put oneself in the driver's seat. As media got more and more imploded and shrunk all of a sudden, one ends up with a Palm Pilot and all this analog media as our content that one can massage. One becomes a director. That's co-anesthesia, as opposed to synesthesia. Synesthesia is the content. Co-anesthesia is the platform, the director's chair, movie director, from which the person experiencing the content synesthesia is viewing the synesthesia. McLuhan understood people were mixing things up with synesthesia, and TV was an extension of that, and they took drugs to mime what TV was doing to them. So the digital, the internet, Web 1.0 and Web 2.0 more and more develop co-anesthesia, so that today, especially with Web 2.0, you are running your own broadcast networks and Instagrams. You've got all kinds of media that you can make movies and TV shows and all kinds of panels and talk shows. Do you see the co-anesthesia comes after synesthesia?
Yes, but you know, I don't think you want to say comes after,
right?
Because then that gets into directionality, and it takes you back into the Gutenberg galaxy. So I would say that what happens with co-anesthesia it's becomes aware of the complexities in synesthesia.
Right, but you are brought into the center. You are the producer, the coordinator of media. You can make your own movies or TV shows.
Yeah, but that's right. But that's what happens at the level of the literal. But at the level of the co-anesthesia itself, the whole idea of being the director or being in the driver's seat falls through itself.
Yes,
that's very much of a Gutenberg galaxy type of image.
Yeah, the Andrew Sarris in the 60s came up with the auteur theory, you know, analyzing French directors and French movie making.
Yep.
And
yep.
That would be a Gutenberg reflection, you know, making a big deal out of the director.
Correct.
The auteur. It's there, but your Gutenberg bias is going to put too much emphasis on him because...
That's right. But in those, at that time, a lot of the of French film was trying to come to grips with that.
Yeah.
How the director is involved in the film, even though you don't see the director directly.
Right.
And so some of the film was trying, like Godard, for example, was trying to account for that sort of presence-absence dialectic in film.
Yes. Maybe that's what 8 and a half was about. Fellini He was discouraging being placed in the director's pedestal, so he had all his problems as a person and as a director, and that's what the movie's about, him ambivalent.
Yeah. And so Boonwell, for example, also got into that problem, but in a different way.
Yeah.
So there was the film in the sort of 60s, 70s, early 80s is very interesting from that point of view. People trying to account for the possibility of making sense through film.
Yeah, the possibility of making sense. Is that what you said?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So we like to say that media shrinks, miniaturizes, gets tinier and tinier, and more is able to be done with it. That's the co-anesthetic trend. That maybe more and more synesthesia is happening anyways, but you're overlaying, and it looks like the focus is on the co-anesthetic. So that's why you say it doesn't really come after, but it looks like separate from synesthesia.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. So McLuhan is a musician. Then I say, no wonder Duke Ellington visited McLuhan. So he had the top musician pretty well in the pop culture, and many people thought jazz was the American classical music. But, you know, you had your classical Stravinsky's and that. But Duke Ellington was a major figure in music. And,
absolutely.
And the fact that he would talk about McLuhan in his concerts, he would visit McLuhan. Mark Stewart, you know, had the diary showing people visiting. She showed it to me. Duke Ellington showed up a couple times in the early 70s. That's really important to understand why someone of Duke Ellington's musical stature, why he respected McLuhan, because McLuhan was speaking to the musician, like as if he was a musician.
Yep.
So Baudrillard is, you know, clever, and I think he's the first to really literally just say that. McLuhan was a musician. What do you say about that? I say that's quadrivial. That's McLuhan and the quadrivium. But what would you say about this musical appellation you put on McLuhan?
Yes, you could say that music defines the problem. Let's say that you want to understand Duke Ellington or Zappa. What does it take to situate oneself in that kind of musical idiom? And that's a very difficult problem. It gets into the problem of the numb. It gets into the problem of the cul-de-sac. Gets into the whole problem of communication.
Okay, so that you've opened it up. Let's go. You talk about the numb in your Canubium article. What would you say here about that? How would you begin to point this out to people, the missing factor in McLuhan's studies of the numbness, which he said was what he discovered? He discovered the medium were extensions of our senses. Others had done that. But he said this numbness is the reason people can't recognize technological change the way he was hoping people could do.
Correct.
And you would try to explain that.
Yes. Well, I haven't published some of the posts that I've done on that. The Canubium post is sort of dipping my toe into that. But I would have to get into the book that McLuhan was referencing just after he had finished Understanding Media.
Mm.
And that's the book on irritation and counter-irritation by McLuhan calls him Adolf Jonas, but the guy's name was actually David. All of his other books were published under the name David Jonas. And the irritation and counter irritation has a different name, I do not know, but that's the way it is.
And that's the only book he knew of Jonas.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, the other books of Jonas might be interesting to you because he went from irritation and counter-irritation, he got married to a woman that was very interested in sort of terrestrial evolution, meaning evolution out of out of the world, out of the earth, out of the planet.
Right. A Gnostic vision?
Well, to me, it's Gnostic, but it's for Jonas and his wife. They published quite a few books actually together, and what they try to do is they try to make sense of human life as a kind of evolution out of the earth.
Is that Teilhard de Chardin?
Well, I don't think they don't reference him, but of course it's related to that.
Yeah.
The whole question, as we're going to get into in your book, is how does linearity come back on itself so that it doesn't lose linearity, but it also realizes the all-at-onceness?
Right. Now, you make a good slight nuance about the term self-amputation. So you extend your eye through books, that's amputating your visual sense. But you say self-amputation can be regarded to the acoustic space that the visual book took over, and knocked off, amputated, removed the old space. Is that what you meant? That's how I was reading it.
Yeah, certainly. The self-amputation, as McLuhan immediately took to that phrase, as was his habit, he kind of reinterpreted it from Jonas. So what McLuhan saw was that self-amputation is sort of the history of the world.
Mm.
So when books... or when the literary, I guess we could say, better than books, in let's say 400 BC in classical Greece, when the alphabet begins to be part of education and part of politics, then there is self-amputation from the acoustic, which doesn't disappear. Self-amputation is just a relative emphasis on the eye versus the ear.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there is a self-amputation from the previous reality into a new reality. And there's also a self-amputation from realities plural. So it's like a hall of mirrors where self-amputation needs to be understood as squared, as something that... sort of takes off into new realms all by itself. It's almost a genetic happening, so that self-amputation leads to another self-amputation and to another and another until you get into the modern world. And we realize that self-amputation has also amputated the self.
Yeah, now I was going to say something there. I don't know. Amputation of the self.
Yeah, that's the history of the modern world, right? That's the cul-de-sac in which we're in. That relates to what we were just talking about with the director and the director's chair.
Right. Now, so is self-amputation causes numbness?
Well, the numbness is already involved in self-amputation.
Right.
So one of the things that happens with the birth of the literary is that what seems like illumination also has a darkness to it. And that the darkness, what it can't see, is a numbness.
Yeah.
A numbness to itself, a numbness to the world, a numbness to the past, a numbness to the future.
Okay, so in your article, you talk about the first of all, italicized. Now, you're not quoting anything when you say first of all, or where does McLuhan say, first of all, where do you get this notion of, or is it just yours, of we have to get back to the first of all?
Yes, so that's, McLuhan doesn't talk about that very much as far as I know, but he does talk about principles. He talks a little bit about origins. So the whole problem for McLuhan, and this is a problem of the tradition from Plato to Heidegger, is just how do you start again?
Yeah.
How do you get from one self to another self? How do you get from one reality to another reality?
And, in retracing the stages of apprehension, you mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the what retracing those stages means is very different depending on how it's looked at.
Yeah.
So you can have retracing as something that's linear, or you can have retracing as something that is not only linear. But the whole problem that we're talking about here is it's literally the case that there are realities, plural. And so when we try to talk about what's going on, there is no talk that is outside some reality.
Yeah.
So talking about realities, plural, happens in the context of reality singular, and that's a difficult problem. That's, you could say that's what Duke Ellington is doing at the piano.
Yeah.
He's playing a tune, but it's not only that tune. He's referencing other ones, and he's doing it in large part through jumps and gaps and what he doesn't play.
Yes.
So it's a very sort of, it's a highly interesting problematic, but it's one that is so difficult that the world has got caught in its impossibility.
Yeah, and McLuhan was noticing how media tend to be like language, spoken language. They move towards becoming more and more linguistic, like people talking. And so texting is more like people talking than maybe email.
Mm-hmm.
So he saw that pattern.
Yeah, he said that the whole need was to have a grammar of the medium.
Yeah, and knowing that all artifacts were words and were tending to becoming speech or some kind of intimate speech, we might call ESP. So I think he has a phrase somewhere, conversation as easy as jazz, or jazz as easy as conversation. Do you remember that sentence?
I think you mentioned it before.
Yeah.
But that's exactly what we're talking about, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, that ties in with Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah.
It's not good enough to say that media are languages, because then you say, well, what's a language?
Yeah.
And so then that kind of language kind of falls through itself, and yet it makes sense.
Right? Yeah.
So when I look at Finnegan's Wake, and I'm certainly not a good reader of Finnegan's Wake, but when I look at it, it's saying to me that the failure of sense is impossible.
Yes, and he says somewhere, as he describes speech as stuttering gaps or something.
Correct.
That's a great line.
Got that out of Finnegan's Wake, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
because Moses stuttered, HCE, I think, stutters, the main character,
yeah,
supposedly.
Absolutely.
But the way he says it, you know, we are numb to the stuttering we're doing as we talk, because the content becomes familiar and we limit ourselves to what we talk about. So it becomes cliche. Okay, so now I'm thinking, what the heck am I doing here at this part? How is this leading to the tech body? So I need to go forward a bit to see why did I bring this point in, the quadrivial? Well, do you agree that McLuhan, as a musician, that he, understanding media, even Gutenberg-Gaussi, are updating his PhD by going out of the trivium and into the quadrivium? What do you think of that?
Yeah,
notion?
I think that's an interesting way of looking at it, sure.
Yeah, because he's dealing with the, as he said, the 20th century, we live entirely by music. So everything is musical, everything's tactile, and he's addressing, as a literate person, he's addressing the issues of that.
Mm-hmm.
The new grammars are based on the gap, not on the connection.
Correct. Correct. So you could say that the trivium is the logic, or is the ontology of the ontical that's named in the quadrivium. And the whole point of those two sort of different spheres is to see how they interrelate. So it's not the case that you can have the quadrivium and not at the same time name the trivium, and also vice versa. So, for example, if you say in chemistry, here's this lump of graphite, is that what carbon is? And the answer is yes, that's what carbon is, but so is this elementary sign on the in the table of chemical elements. And so the whole key in chemistry is to see how those are the same in some important sense, but of course they're also completely different. And similarly with the trivium and the quadrivium.
Are you saying the ontological tends to be in the trivium and the ontic is in the quadrivium?
Well, that's one way of understanding it, but I'm not saying that that's the only way.
Yeah, that's a Gutenberg effect.
Yeah, you can. It's also possible to reverse that. So McLuhan always talked about how figure and ground can only be understood when you realize that the ground can be a figure.
Right. How did you define earlier to me ontic? It's the particular, whereas the ontological is the big being?
It's particular is exactly the right word. Ontic is the world of particularities, including particular selves, including particular times, including particular stuff. And the great question is, what is its reality? And that gets into the musical because it turns out that reality is not something like Thompson might describe as something apart from particularity. Particularity is the expression of the ontological.
And the real?
Yeah. So, I mean, all of these words have different meanings, right? So everybody understands the real in terms of what I can touch and what I can see and all that sort of stuff. But the real can also be understood as what's the structure of that reality. And so you have different senses to the word or the concept of reality. And great need is to understand their musicality, their interpenetration, their difference, preserving the gap, but their interaction, their implication of the other.
Right. So I have here Zappa was the Duke Ellington of his generation. Then McLuhan played off dialectics, Duns Scotus, who split and divided everything. As a philosopher, grammar is Aquinas, and rhetoric is Augustine. So he played off dialectics, grammar, rhetoric, the trivium, and music from the quadrivium, Ezra Pound, sticking at no station for long. His was the silence of tactility, and that's Wyndham Lewis. So Stern says, asks McLuhan, will there ever be silence? And McLuhan says, objects are unobservable. Only relationships among objects are observable. Have you thought much about that thing, that question and answer in particular?
Sure. I've thought about that for 50 or 60 years.
Yeah, right, because the relationships are your emphasis on gap in the interval. The relationships among objects are observable. We only know by the gap.
Yes. Yeah, but what happens when the gap is properly understood then the object becomes observable in a whole new sense.
Yes. And that is that the Joyce's integritas claritas consonantia, where the object becomes an epiphany? This was in...
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
But that's also... that what's named there is also the logic or the musicality, we could say, of what appears.
Yeah.
But when the object is epiphany, it has brought a certain kind of relationship with it, and so it's not the object per se that is seen. It's the object in the light of a certain relationship, and that reception of the light, which McLuhan calls iconic, is how the epiphany works.
Right. I think McLuhan said only the ground changes, the figure never changes. And then he hasn't taken today, humans are the figure, man is the figure, and the ground is the social matrix, the social media, technologies and their environments. That's what changes. That's the ground. So if you take a visually biased culture with the book, the figure aspect of non-changing becomes obsessed. You obsess over it, and you miss the ground factor of the change. So
Right. The
flaw of the Gutenberg galaxy was they missed the dynamics of what McLuhan called a transformational change or media change. They didn't have a theory of change. They were trying to fix on essences, elements, objectivity.
Right.
You know,
right? They were trying to use process to get beyond process.
Yes. Yeah. So
you could say that for them, process was a figure, and beyond process was ground. And McLuhan wants to set those things in a dynamic relationship.
Yes. And I have here, let's see. Nevitt. Okay, so are you listening to the Monday night seminars that Andrew is posting?
I only listened to a little bit of the first one. That's something that I have to do. I did note when I listened to about half of the first one that the transcript in Google was very good, which is unusual.
Yeah.
I've got the I've downloaded that transcript, and I listened to the first half of the first seminar that Andrew put up. I listened with the transcript, and I found it interesting.
Okay, so I'm scanning down to find the Barry Nevitt quote in the last minute of number two or three. He's put up three? I think he's put up three. So I'm just scrolling down to find it, because Barry says an interesting thing at the end. So I'm just scrolling down, because I posted it. Where is it going to be?
Are you scrolling in your book?
No, my Facebook page. I posted the quote that I got to get down there and find a week or two ago. So I'm just scrolling.
Did you search on Barry?
Yeah, I'm...
Nevitt or something?
Here it is. So within the last minute, they're saying something. And then Barry says, so what we're seeing is that the old ground rules reverse and change. And the question is, what are the new ground rules? So there aren't any. They're process patterns. So I was thinking about this, and people complain that news is just opinionating now. Just, you know, Fox and CNN, they just give their opinions about what's going on. Constant talking.
Right.
So
yeah, people can see that there's always somebody sitting in the driver's seat.
Right.
That's become obvious.
Right. So they don't give news items. That's objects. They're constantly engaged in process pattern. And McLuhan said that's more and more the participation mystique. Each new electric and digital technology brings you more involving, makes you more, quote, hypnotized by the process. And so people are not giving news anymore, or news items don't give perception. The processing of what people have experienced in, for a couple of days in the news stories or whatever they're picking up from the massive amount of information that's available for them. So we're doing, the ground is not a technology. It's information, but it's what Barry's calling process patterns. So this is an interesting point he's making. The question is, what are the new ground rules? Which you could say, what is the new medium? Then he goes, so there aren't any. They're process patterns. So we are totally in a world of talking. All media have become talking. And that's what everybody is processing all the time, every day. The talking in the talking heads and all the different forms of, what are they called, blogs and panels and opinion on the mainstream media.
Yeah, and tweets. And,
yeah, tweeting and yeah. Instagram. And what's the new one? TikTok. So I realize that, you know, I'm taking Barry's maybe words out of context, but I think that what I'm pointing out would get people to relax and stop demanding news. That kind of demand, you know, they're saying, I'm not getting any news. I'm not listening to these people opinionating. But they can't stop listening because they're engaging in the effect of our weird no technology world now, software participation, and engaging in and making process patterns. And everybody gets in, and they all start having their own place where they're projecting their process patterning. This was a new insight I got lately. Do you see what I'm saying? It's sort of an explanation of the grievance that we're not getting news anymore.
Yeah, I mean, for my purposes, it's people are aware of being integrated or implicated in a process that they don't understand. All they understand is that something very complicated is going on in which they're lost.
Right. And if you saw that clearly, that you will be forced to engage process patterns, then you would not be driven by looking for the old Gutenberg effect of what's the significant news item, what will tell
Correct.
Us where we're going.
Correct.
You know, and the more you see that, you can relax and stop trying to see where you're going and just watch everybody get more and more involved in the arguments. And they call it a more divisive America, right? It's more divisive or divisive, whatever the word is. And they bemoan this. This is horrible. But it's all part of the tactile interplay of on and off or figure ground, the perpetual transformation that we will not get out of unless we turn the environment off. It's the only way it's going to stop. If we really want it and it's driving us all crazy, we better turn it off. You see what I'm saying?
I do, but the turning off and turning on are that's a primordial thing.
Yeah.
So it's not as if you can just turn off by becoming unconscious or by killing yourself or by getting on a rocket and going someplace. The need is to understand that there's something about ground that implicates groundlessness. So what I don't like about Barry's quote is it's not the case that the answer is that there is no answer. Rather, the lack of an answer is a kind of challenge. It's we need to see how a lack of an answer is somehow compatible with ground.
Yeah.
And that perception is, I think, what we were earlier talking about as musicality.
Yes. So Well, the problem is now it's become this surround I'm calling the tech body. And there's something new about this endless involvement with the tech body. The tech body may have figured a way to be the ultimate director, go anesthetic and hijack the process. So, but that's what we're going to try to find out if I get there to that point.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Good. That's, you know, that's the question of
that's
where
problem.
We are. Where we're at.
Yeah, it's the problem I'm working on here. Objects are unobservable. Only relationships among objects are observable. I mean, that's amazing. There can't be silence as an object. And so people, they yearn for silence. They think they're getting it. But there's never pure silence because there's never anything that's pure itself. What's that, pure ontic? There's no pure particularity.
Yeah, well, there's no pure ontological and there's no pure ontic.
Okay.
They implicate each other.
Right. Okay, so then I say any theory of agency applied to McLuhan would have to include the interplay of most of the contemporary theories. So these theories are object-oriented ontology. Now, you know about ontology and Nietzsche and Heidegger. Do you know what is object-oriented ontology? You ever heard of that?
I've seen the phrase, but I've never read anything about it. I'm not too interested in that. But the phrase itself is interesting because it might be read as saying that ontology of itself reaches out of itself. The interesting thing about McLuhan is when he talks about technology as an extension of the human, the word extension is usually understood as something that sort of occurs in the world. People invent the telescope or the microscope or the telephone or whatever, and extension is just simply understood as something that kind of belongs to human beings. But for McLuhan, extension is the what might be called the alienation of ontology. It's the iconic expression of ontology. And so extension of man is not subjective genitive where of man would be belongs to man. Rather, the extension of man, man is an object. What is it that gets extended? Human being. Where does human being get extended? Into an alienated world that thinks that its complex is all there is. And I think I hear you saying that is exactly what this dark figure is.
Yeah.
That it's this seemingly self-contained, self-grounded matrix that people cling to because they fear what would happen if they didn't cling to it.
Yeah.
And that's the numb, actually, right there.
Yeah, McLuhan said, I think in Understanding Media, that when he's writing, he looks around and grabs at anything. He just, okay, I can use this, I'll use that. And,
absolutely. Just think of a chemist, how ridiculous it would be to think that there was anything in the chemist's world that wasn't subject to chemical analysis. It would be absurd.
Right.
But that view of physical nature is only a couple hundred years old. And what McLuhan, I believe, was trying to say is, well, look, I mean, why can't we regard human reality like that? Why is there anything that is not analyzable and
applicable?
A kind of epiphany.
Right. So I'm thinking that I saw somewhere object-oriented ontology, didn't know what it was, actor network theory, never went to that classroom, and relational agency. I can take the words and make up meanings, but it's probably not the meanings of the context it came from. But I grabbed as samples, for some reason, these words. I said, this is sort of getting at what I'm saying. And I say that these phrases are a replay of how McLuhan played with the trivium and the quadrivium in every paragraph he wrote. So
correct.
It's an odd sentence, but it is part of the making process where you don't necessarily know what you're saying. But
correct. So notice you use the word played there, and earlier we were talking about Duke Ellington.
Yeah.
So what is being played? And there you name it. You say include the interplay, and then later you say the replay.
Right.
And this interplay, replay, played with, that is a kind of ballet or dance or music that human beings need to understand in the sense of placing themselves under, and that's the only way to get out of this mass hypnosis or mass confusion that currently reigns.
Right. I'm thinking of if there's no time, then there's no past, present, future. So I'm playing with past, present, future, and I'm calling it play, interplay, and replay.
Right.
That's past, present, future.
Right. But it's not that there's no time. And instead, there's multiple times, and you can't understand multiple times without getting away from the numb and getting into the I'm just letting the dog out the door here.
Yeah.
So if we get
he appears in every episode, that dog.
That's right. That's Pogo.
Okay. Did we disrupt you too much? You forgot what you were saying?
Well, I've sort of become a little bit disconnected, but we were talking about time.
Oh, yeah, there's multiple times. Multiple times.
That's right. And your book gets into that, actually, just coming up.
Yeah.
In the Dilworth citation.
Yes.
What's interesting here is that the plurality of time seems to be the hurdle that nobody has been able to understand over, let's say, a 5,000-year period.
Yeah.
Or better said, those that did understand it couldn't communicate. And I see that as sort of McLuhan's problem.
Yeah.
How do you communicate multiple times?
Yeah, what did he used to say? The communication of the new is a miracle, but not impossible.
Yeah.
That was his hope. He was an optimist.
That's right. That's right. That's right. So what I see missing in the quotation that you had from Barry is that you would think if somebody said, well, there are no patterns, then they couldn't be a Catholic.
Yeah.
But for McLuhan, the fact that there are no patterns was involved with or implicated with him being a Catholic.
Yeah. He had to make it up. That's why George Thompson says McLuhan was not like any other Catholic, to the point that George said McLuhan was not a Catholic. He's not like any other Catholic. Yeah, he said that.
Yeah. Oh, I believe he said it, but I don't think he really understood McLuhan's view of being a Catholic. I think he would have said, yes, I'm different from every other Catholic, and I'm also exactly the same as every other Catholic.
Mm.
He wouldn't, I mean, to claim some sort of special status is ridiculous in terms of being a Catholic. I mean, you go to church and there's a whole bunch of churchgoers there, and you're one of them, and you're trying to sort of retrieve a message that comes to us through that liturgy, where liturgy is a Greek word meaning the work of the people, right? Liturgy has the same root as energy. So liturgy and energy are closely related. It has to do with, on the one hand, the work of physical materials is energy, and liturgy is the work of the people.
Right. But McLuhan felt that there was a new problem for conscience, for morals or ethics, or having a sense of righteousness and being a Catholic, and that's where he was different. He felt that there was, and this comes out in his talks with that guy in the Electric Light book, that he is saying there's an issue here that the Pope, nobody's dealing with, a new challenge to being a Christian.
Absolutely. I wasn't at all saying that he thought that being a Catholic was unproblematic or something. He thought it was greatly problematic, and he thought that the Church, by not understanding how complicated its message is and its history is, that the Church was sort of missing the boat.
Yeah.
Yeah, but on the other hand, that didn't separate him from all sorts of people in the church, in the history of the church. It bound him to them.
Yeah.
Because the way the church works is that it's always falling away from its mission, and then people have to recall it, retrieve it. And McLuhan saw himself in that context.
Are you a Catholic? Were you brought up as a Catholic?
No, but I think I understand what it means. I enjoy going to Mass. I enjoy going to Orthodox liturgy. I enjoy going to the liturgies of really any religion, as long as they don't get into some sort of Rotarian message about doing good in the world or something.
Mm.
So,
okay. So that's enough explanation. That's good enough. So then we have pulled from a paraphrased summary of a March 1973 talk at St. Basil's Seminary. That's McLuhan's church at St. Michael's College in the University of Toronto campus, for those who don't know. And I'm amazed at this quote that I found. I do have a book, At the Speed of Light, There's Only Illumination. That's a collection of papers presented at a McLuhan conference in Ottawa around 2004.
Right.
Were you aware of that book?
Yes, I have it.
Okay. So it says, I have here a paraphrase of McLuhan by Tom Dilworth.
Yeah.
So look what he says. He says, Tired de Chardin fell into... He's saying this is what McLuhan said. Tired
yes.
de Chardin fell into the trap of thinking there was a direction, which we've been just saying. Newman fell into the same trap. Evolution is an unfortunate metaphor. Clock time is visual. Other cultures don't have it, and is useless even as a metaphor at the speed of light. Under conditions of literacy, continuum makes sense. Acoustic man lives not in a continuum, but in a sphere without margin or center. Man, the spheros, or sphere, acoustic, simultaneous man, is back together with a rush, Humpty Dumpty. At the speed of light, there is only illumination. Tactile, smelling, hearing man senses no continuum. Spengler was right. Western man went down the hill and he disappeared. Now, that's a pretty interesting speech that McLuhan was making. These are just...
Absolutely. So to say that to seminarians, that's a big deal.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm glad I found that quote. So then I say, the new spherical global theater as opposed to the visual linear evolution-oriented Gutenberg space. You know how people, your normal, well-educated person, thinks that Darwin was right, and they would they mock the religious people, generally fundamentalists who believe in creationism and that stuff, and there's such a snobbery there. And then you see McLuhan's last line is that his vision mocks the evolutionists, derides the evolutionists. I don't think anybody picked up that McLuhan was not a Darwinian, you know? Which would appall people, because everybody, at least back in the 60s, you had to be a Darwinian. That was a fact, right?
Yep.
So this is a to get rid of your, you don't have to become a creationist, but to realize the limitations of Darwin is a deeper understanding of McLuhan. You have to drop that bias, or, you know, just maybe just recognize it as another product of the Gutenberg era of speculation, the theory. But that, to the degree that you're not afraid to say, to question evolution, is a measure of your understanding of McLuhan, because that's what he was doing.
Absolutely. So he talked a lot about the problem of the missing link.
Yes.
Right? So
he said he made an interesting thought. He said that was the big discovery of the 19th century, not the connecting evolutionary theory, but the missing link. That was the
correct
big discovery, which is pretty neat.
Correct. Yeah. So notice by putting the Dilworth quote in your book here, you're circling back to the end of War and Peace.
Yeah.
Right? So the way you're composing here is sort of in spirals.
Yes. Yep. Baroque spirals. That's a section of my chart. So, well, that's great that you noticed that. So then, still trying to see where I'm going. Is there a direction possible? The medium is the message only under electronic conditions. I don't say only, but I think that's what I'm meaning there. The medium is the message under electronic conditions. The medium is not the message in the Gutenberg era.
That's right.
Okay.
I mean, the medium always was the message, but the Gutenberg galaxy is numbed to that reality.
That's right. That's its message.
That's right.
Yeah. You got people running around for 300 years recognizing or forgetting that the medium is the message, and not noticing that this particular medium has a particular message that they're robotically stuck in.
Right.
And it took the electronic disaster, the Armageddon of electric technologies, beginning with the telegraph, to wrench people out of that.
Well, you would think that, but in fact, all that happened with this electronic disaster was that people became more entrenched with Gutenberg, and that's where we are today.
Yeah, but
we're in an electronic world that is captured by print. It's ridiculous.
Right. And people thought that all these changes, vast changes coming in rapidly, but then you find one little place where he said, well, we're going to be stuck in the Gutenberg hangover for another 150, 200 years. Nobody thought change was that slow when reading McLuhan, because he gave a sense of acceleration. But he recognized what you're saying is that, no, this hangover, the Gutenberg, is going to take a long time. It took us a long time to get into it. You know, it's the slowest medium acquisition, literacy, or the printed book, and it'll take a long time to get out of it.
Correct. So the obsolete sort of takes over the world.
Yeah. That is the they're calling it globalism, conspiracy theory, the cabal, all these pointing fingers at something at the top, some human grouping or something that's hijacked the planet.
Right.
That's not an accurate perception of what's going on.
For sure, because a lot of, it's not as if all of that is completely false. It's that the vision of that usually doesn't understand itself.
Yes.
So if you're just pointing to something else as the problem, nearly always there is something problematic in your conception of that.
Right. So if you go on about George Soros, you're missing the point that Soros, because of the nature of Gutenberg effects, there has to be someone at the figure, the organization man chart, there has to be a hierarchy in visual space, and he is not consciously controlling everybody. He's trapped just like you and your neighbor.
Correct. Absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a very important perception there.
And that's why if I was brought into the Bilderbergers, you wouldn't point fingers. You would try to, because they're all generally there trying to figure out who's screwing them, or like just take the whole trucker thing. Look at the confusion over who caused what in the convoy in Ottawa, right? And So the point is, McLuhan gave us a way to talk about the situation without putting the blame in everybody. And he would even say, I can't be moral about this, because how can we blame humanity when they're lost in huge environmental realities, new natural, new natures?
That's right. And I myself, as a Catholic, know that I don't see everything, and I don't see everything correctly, and I'm always screwing up. So it's part of my vision of what's going on that I'm not necessarily correct, right? If you don't like that failure, then I've got lots more.
What was I going to say? That the exploring ignorance for discovery. That was McLuhan's mantra.
Absolutely. Yeah. Think how wonderful it is for a scientist. Like they've found the physicists in using these new telescopes. They've found out that galaxies have shapes that they can't explain.
Wow.
There's too many galaxies that are in a disc shape. So everybody's happy knowing that they can't explain it, because when they grapple with it and gradually come to understand it, then they will extend the science. So not knowing something is very, very valuable and very exciting.
Yeah. It levels the playing field? Is that the phrase? It brings everybody back into this, the same problem, the original problem, questing for some issue that's a problem that gets forgotten when you start getting bogged down in getting answers and then learning something new. When you learn something new, that will create new unforeseen effects. And then that will cause division or disagreement, and you lose the harmony of everybody not knowing until something new really does disrupt everything. And everybody then is back in the same boat, agreeing that we're ignorant.
we're ignorant, and that not only is okay, it also is perceptive of reality.
Yeah.
Right? So being perceptive of reality doesn't mean that we are matching it. It means that in our making, we understand it, even though our making is not absolute.
Right. Ian said, the advantage you have, Bob, is you know more than most people that you don't know.
Correct.
Or that you know what you don't know. You know, variations on that. But that's a big factor.
Yeah. So that's how the whole Western tradition starts, right?
Yeah.
Socrates says, it's not the case that I'm trying to teach something. I'm trying to teach a problem.
Yeah.
And the problem is that when I think about virtue or courage or the good, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't understand what those things are.
And I don't know if it's a problem or not that I don't know.
Yeah, that's this whole cloud of unknowing is how philosophy in the Western tradition starts, and the tradition, aside from certain great artists and philosophers and theologians and filmmakers and poets, aside from those people, which are sort of like mountains whose tops are obscured in clouds, the whole tradition has been involved in trying to end those problems. It's as if we could somehow find something that brought us into that boat that you were just talking about,
yeah.
And that boat would be all of us together in some reality. But that's not what reality is. Reality is extended. It's extended outside of itself.
Yeah.
And that's the great mystery.
Okay. So I say Dilworth's quotation above is a great example of the obsolescence applying McLuhan's meaning that everyone's doing it. When something's obsolete, everybody's doing it.
Correct.
Applying McLuhan's meaning that everyone's doing it. It's a great example of the obsolescence by the and/or meme of even the best of McLuhan's revelations. So, yes, I'm starting to point out that the new environment, the Android meme phase, which is not the tech body yet, but I'm trying to say, look, there's something that's been going on the last 20, 30 years that McLuhan's content doesn't help, doesn't get to the problem. And so
If it's seen as content, that's right.
Right. So I say this is why some critics of McLuhan see McLuhan as a hack whose tactics were hijacked by everybody, merging McLuhan with the ground, and his work failing to provide an effective anti-environment. This is especially accurate today, even though McLuhan was an effective anti-environment in the 60s. The anti-environment for now is something completely different, Monty Python in the early 70s. Media colleges and journalists like to cite McLuhan's hot and cool dialectic and or Neil Postman's amusing yourselves to death as entrees into understanding the appeal, charisma, or raison d'etre of the era of Donald Trump. But I would say that doesn't apply. What do I say? I say in the blue portion, media colleges and journalists do not get at the essence of Donald Trump. All the articles say, wow, Trump is just an entertainment guy. He's a president who entertains us. That's what Neil Postman predicted back in 85. Then I say, nope, Trump's way more than that. Then I say both McLuhan and Postman are, again, mostly inadequate and even useless. Now, in our discussions, we find aspects of McLuhan, like the Knubel, that no one talked about. So I think I'm generally saying the cliche understandings of McLuhan, the global village, hot and cool, whatever, they don't work, but there's a whole bunch of secret stuff in McLuhan that if you find, you'll be inspired to write a book, which I just did. So, and I think we're bringing that out. I don't think no one has ever heard anybody discuss McLuhan the way we're doing it.
Yeah, so I agree with you because the whole problem is that all words, including all of McLuhan's words, are contextualized.
Yeah.
And what the great need is to understand context, plural. And how to do that is a very great problem. And probably McLuhan didn't solve it or wasn't able to bring that need into some sort of resolution. Right?
Yeah.
So McLuhan changed very much over his career how he was attempting to communicate.
Yeah.
And as far as I can see, he never did. Right?
Yeah.
With his own kids, for example, only Eric became a Catholic or remained a Catholic, I guess I should say.
Yeah.
And all of the other kids dropped out. And that represented a tremendous failure of communication on McLuhan's part and one that he deeply regretted.
Right. So, and another thing is that he didn't get his, advanced perceptions of what was going on, it never got said to anybody. Nobody else got it as much as he did. So he failed to leave what do you call a successor? Something
yeah, absolutely.
Adequate
absolutely.
Successor.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one way of seeing his papers in Ottawa. It's the amount that the man wrote and talked about in that we have in tapes or lectured that we have in videos and stuff. The sheer amount of stuff there is incredible.
Yeah.
And that betrays the energy that McLuhan had to try to solve this problem.
Yeah.
So it may be that his papers in the future will have an effect that he himself in his lifetime did not have.
Yeah. He was too involved in creating output and no one got to the position of looking at all that he was saying. He didn't even get it all done. it's the way I'm feeling. I'm reading this thing and saying, what the heck did I write here? Where was I going? You know?
Yeah, that's a good way to look at one's own stuff, for sure.
Yeah, yeah, I'm really enjoying this. I don't know if there's many writers, thinkers, like that Heidegger. Did he have somebody? Did they record him getting some buddies to help him figure out what his book meant? You know? I don't think that's been done before. It's maybe a first-time thing here.
All great thinkers are continually trying to go backwards with their thought. All great thinkers try to see what was implicated in what they wrote or what they said that they weren't able to bring out. And so they, when a great thinker writes or talks, what's at stake is trying to get at what was not written or not said previously by that thinker.
Yeah.
So that's a good example of your quotation here with Deschardins fell into the trap of thinking there was a direction. Newman fell into the same trap. Evolution is an unfortunate metaphor. Clock time is visual. And so all great thinkers do not think in an evolutionary way. They go backwards. They're trying to clarify what's at stake in what they already said but didn't say it right.
Yeah, a friend of mine found out that the word repent originally meant to retrace.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so...
Retrace stages of apprehension.
We've talked in the past about RE words.
Yeah.
I think your wife's products are mostly RE words. And for McLuhan, there's like 20 different RE words that he plays with, like replay, retrieve, rediscover, on and on and on.
What about Renaissance? Does that qualify?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, that means rebirth, right?
Yeah. Okay, so Corinne once said to Marg Stewart, Marshall didn't love me, he loved his work first. So that's someone who's obsessed and, quote, becomes a great thinker, so to speak, because of their obsession. But even to she was wise that she was second to his work. You know what I mean?
Right.
And the children...
But imagine somebody... Corinne, as you know, was a very, very strong person.
Yeah.
That's probably what Elsie saw in Corinne and wanted to get
Marshall
together with Marshall.
Yeah.
So imagine the strength it takes to appreciate that somebody has more direction to something that's not you than to you.
Yeah.
Right? And remember, this is a woman that had 6 children with the man.
Yeah.
Right? And often dealt with him more or less as the 7th child.
That's right. Yeah. Right. The kids...
It's a very complex thing.
They've said, I've talked to Mary about it, but for McLuhan, for the kids, Marshall was a guy laying on the couch reading poetry all the time.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't interacting. And then Corinne says in some interview, it's in the public, she says, McLuhan, he was in love with the idea of being a family man.
Correct. Correct.
He never really did it.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You can see that in the letters that he wrote to Corinne just before they got married.
Right.
I mean, it's he's living in a sort of theological cloud is going to come into extreme conflict with the reality of being the father of a bunch of children, needing to get money to feed everybody and to heat people and Canadian winter and all that sort of stuff. That's one of the things that got him out of the Gutenberg Galaxy in around 1950.
Yes, that's why he got into consulting, or what is it, moonlighting, they call it, back then?
Yeah, I guess so. That's a great phrase for him.
Yeah, so Marshall McLuhan. So Don Thiel talked about that era. Okay, so he's the confidant of McLuhan, 50 to 52, 53. And mm-hmm. they were the two lay people at St. Mike's. All the other people were priests, and they were the teachers, and you had these two guys who weren't priests. And they got really low salary, and they're starting to have lots of kids. It was really a problem economically working at St. Mike's.
Absolutely.
For Don
absolutely.
And Marshall.
The Canadian at the time, Jill Soane was another
lay
guy that was teaching there. And all of them were trying to deal with Canadian tax law,
yeah.
which, I mean, there were people in Ottawa that didn't do anything but to try to tax people that were earning $2,000 or $3,000 a year.
Yeah.
Trying to tax them. And meanwhile, the people that were really rich weren't paying any taxes at all because they had great lawyers.
Yep.
So, so that was a situation that McLuhan knew about. He deeply regretted it, but he also saw the humor in it.
Yep. Okay, so then I say both McLuhan and Postman are, again, mostly inadequate and even useless. They're so cliche that they offer no keen perception on the obscene, that's in quotes, today. Then I say, basically, as Jean Baudrillard pointed out, more and more of everything got exposed in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. People got bored because all that had been risque or underground or unconscious was now right in their face. It was shocking for a while, and then they became numb. Obscenity became non-obscene, so people had to find their tactile contrasts elsewhere. With porn such as Deep Throat, 1972, that's literally the obscene in the old terms. Violence in the media, with porn such as Deep Throat, the obscene in the old terms, violence in the media became the new obscene. As the media served up more and more violent scenes, people thought the world was getting more violent, especially the older people who were locked in and had nothing to do but watch TV. McLuhan talked about the book Subliminal Seduction by Wilson Brian Key concerning advertising embedding images. Wilson Key, a friend of McLuhan, discovered these subliminals in the early 70s while attending McLuhan's seminar. He was a professor at another university who wrote the above book, Subliminal Seduction, got in big trouble with the advertising world, then got fired from the university. But McLuhan had written an introduction to the book in which he said, quote, "The close relation between sex and violence, between good news and bad news, helps to explain the compulsion of the ad men to dunk all their products in sex by erogenizing every contour of every bottle of cigarette. Having reached this happy state where the good news is fairly popping, the admin said, as it were, quote, better add a bit of the bad news now to take the hex off all that bonanza stuff." Pretty neat. Okay.
So, yeah, absolutely.
And
I
got one more
he
thing.
Could have,
what he says, so he saw, he answers, you know, Key didn't understand why this was going on, but in his foreword, McLuhan explained that, look, you're going to get more violent images. That always happens when there's more sexual imagery, I guess you'd call it. They go together, and that's why the death images and the sex images are in the same ads. And that was this
right.
old thing, you know, good news sells bad news helps people put up with good news because good news is a problem, demands you to change and get something new. So what were you going to say?
I was going to say that all he could have said all of this stuff in The Mechanical Bride.
Yeah.
So this is stuff that he already saw in the 1940s.
Yep.
And the introduction that he did to Key's book, isn't that in the early 70s or something?
Yeah, early 70s. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's kind of retrieving what he had said almost 30 years before, and that nobody has picked up.
Well, Clinton is getting access to him, and sometimes he'll read to me McLuhan's 40s writing, and boy, that's a whole different character, that guy in the 40s, what he's writing,
right.
And banging his head up against everybody. Everybody's stupid. They don't see anything. He sees it all, and he's disgusted. And I guess Mechanical Bride, because that kind of failed, he had to check himself And he did that through talking to Pound, Innes, Carpenter, and Don Thiel, and maybe a few other people in there. That he really went through a major transformation in the early 50s or late 40s.
Correct.
Yeah.
So he saw the medium at work in his previous thought.
Yeah.
And that medium was literary point of view.
Yeah. Which, so, he used to say he likes people with big egos. That's a bit of a put on, but that's being in any environment to the present. Everybody becomes nobody. But he was being a big ego in the 40s, maybe unconsciously, until he recognized.
Yeah. He thought he was a big ego, you could say, and then he found out that he was kind of a piece of shit,
yeah.
And he had to deal with that reality.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's a prudish projection by McLuhan, but definitely as people seem to get more open about different ways of having sex, the world also seemed to get more violent. And then people started saying, well, my private ethics is nobody's business. I'll do what I want, but you better be a greeny politician and wear your conscience on your sleeve. I want purity, not in my private life, but in the public sphere.
Correct.
See, that's a nice switch. The people became very slack about their private ethics, but they demanded to compensate for that. In other words, they always had to have the harmony, so you got to overdo and demand your politicians to be super pure.
Right. And McLuhan talked about that a lot in the 1970s, right?
Yeah.
So that is definitely something that he thought that was maybe some way of communicating what he wanted to communicate by pointing out to people the paradoxes or the conflicts in their own thinking.
Yeah, the
between themselves and
the hypocrisies in.
Right.
Right there. He was pointing out new levels of hypocrisy, new complications of it.
Correct.
Okay, is this a thought? Because people couldn't see the new hypocrisies and the old ones didn't have any power anymore, so people relaxed about being hypocritical in the old way, right? Because it didn't see, because the pressure was somewhere else and they didn't know where it was or didn't even know the pressure was somewhere else. But then McLuhan came along to point out where they were hypocritical and didn't notice it. And
correct. So that relates to the Barry quotation that you gave from your Facebook page. Because what's happening there is that people are trying to find a ground. And the ground that they think they find is to say, well, there is no ground. There's just everybody just has their own point of view. And as long as I'm happy with myself, is sort of what reality is. Trying to be happy with yourself. And then somebody else says, well, look at how ignorant that is or something. And then you say, well, being ignorant is part of how I'm relaxed, into a reality or something like this.
Yes.
So there's what you're talking about here is an attempt to find ground by denying that there is anything like ground.
At which the modern environment created that perception. That was
absolutely
one of the effects. That's one of the effects.
Yeah. So people are involved in a cloud of assumptions that they're unaware of.
Yes. And that's always the case. And the sneaky assumptions, they change, and you think you've mastered some. Oh, no, those ones just got removed. They're obsolete. There's a new bunch of assumptions you haven't noticed yet.
Correct. And so then the involved in that is seeing a previous numb and also a kind of abysmal gap that you need to navigate in order to get from an old numb to a new numb. And the so what's so important about McLuhan around 1950 and what I call his second conversion is he came to understand that he himself as a person and his work needed to come to terms with the limitations of making, as opposed to making the assumption that there was matching going on. McLuhan, up until 1950, was sort of trying to match some sort of ethical ideal or something.
Yeah.
And he failed. He necessarily failed. And coming to terms with that necessary failure is what was the motor of his work in the 1950s.
Yes, and then he says in the 70s, in his last recorded interview, I think we have, that he's not interested in happiness. He's exploring suffering all the time. So mm-hmm. he had done a lot of it, 30 years of it, of enjoying the advantages of suffering.
Right.
Which are these transformations that he kept being forced to go through. Like my pattern, every time a new medium came in, he got ill.
Yeah, yeah. So it's there's a physical problem going on and a psychological problem going on, and the two are in interplay.
Yeah, and if you keep processing them, digesting them, you won't die of cancer or something. You know, he had his colleagues were dying. He kept going, even though he only lasted 69 years, but he had put himself into the fight, into the frying pan, and survived pretty good since he was allowing himself to suffer or to get into problems where he'd have to check what his assumptions were. That's the real, I guess I would say, Christian lifestyle.
Yeah,
that's what
I
you
agree.
Have to do.
I agree, yeah. So he knew that his health was in terrible shape starting in the late 1950s. That's when he started to have the blackout.
Yeah.
He knew that he might not be able to realize the goals that he had set himself. And that's coming to terms with that and trying to communicate how that failure is okay is, you know, a very important thing to do. It's a great topic for thought, but it's certainly not a happy one.
Right, and that's why he dropped the value judgments. That was the public banner of what he was going through that you've just been describing.
Yeah, yeah, so that happens. He himself thought that happened in the late 1940s when he gave up the idea that he sort of knew what was going on. He gave up kind of attachment to Leavis thought that instead of looking to what Leavis called continuity, that is to say, attachment to the tradition. McLuhan saw that we were already beyond the old tradition, and we had to come to terms with that.
Yeah.
First of all, personally.
Yes. So we're at page 87, and it's just part two after all that. Let me just see the beginning here. I've got global. So that all, 87 pages. Well, 77 is Global Village, and now we're just getting into Global Theater, and then we have to get into Global Membrane, then Android Meme Phase 1 and 2, then the Anthropomorphic Physical. So I guess what I've done is summarized the knowable McLuhan, but highlighting things that people didn't know, areas that mm-hmm. he was thinking about. Not
sure.
The cliche. So I'm trying to break out the old, renew the image of McLuhan himself and get rid of the cliches, but then begin to analyze something that was bypassing everybody, including McLuhan, which would be the Global Theater and the Android Meme. Now, McLuhan, he knew it. Maybe he couldn't find a way to say it, but just sort of recognizing that he knew what other people didn't know, where he saw the problems was as far as he could get. And it is pretty hard to communicate it, to communicate this new situation. And,
right.
And the world, everybody in all fields has been floundering. And,
yeah, so by taking up McLuhan's failures, we're becoming the best kind of student.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We're not, if we just come to praise Caesar, then we're being sycophants.
Yeah.
But what we need to do and what McLuhan himself was doing was seeing the complications that were implicated in his work.
Yeah, the work wrote itself in a way, and he would look as, wow, those are tough questions that my work says back to me.
Absolutely. That's why I like conversation.
Yeah, yeah. He said that was the best art form, conversation.
Yeah.
So, yes, I'm sort of saying, I'm going to show that McLuhan is pretty worthwhile studying, even today. But you got to recognize the problems that he saw coming and never had a chance to talk about them. So I'm trying
sure.
to talk about what McLuhan didn't get to say.
Correct. So think about any of the physical sciences. What's interesting about them is that when they look at their present work, let alone the past work. But when a science looks at its present work, what it's interested in is what it doesn't know.
Yeah.
So if we interrogate McLuhan in terms of what's implicated here but not said directly or something, that's the best way of reading him.
Yeah. So I saw, Ed had some lady who handles insurance claims or studies the insurance industry and how they're really floundering in the COVID crisis. And then in passing, she says, there's more and more papers being published, but 90% of them is crap. Now, the public debate is between the pro-science and the questioning science, right? If you're a vaxxer, you believe in science. And it's an obsolete icon going on. And Carolyn saw this in medicine. There's more and more sloppy studies, bad studies, wrong studies, and even the New England Journal of Medicine person about 20 years ago, the editor, quit because she saw there was so much corruption in the studies, people selling their stuff. So we are arguing over science, and that's not the issue anymore, or, the old industrial or Gutenberg science. That is not the science that we're talking about. And you have in your Knubley article, you, in an eccentric way, start defining science in a new way. Following along what Canuvio meant, right? You're saying
Correct.
There, this new science, but you're not talking about the scientists like Fauci and those guys. So this is a big, McLuhan might say, well, the hidden ground today is that the religion of science, the pagan religion of science, ain't working. It's failed. And yet that's what people will fight to defend. Keep the people... These renegade terrorists who are dumping science. Now, they don't know why they're doing it, but they're recognizing that there's something inadequate. And this woman who handles insurance claims and how badly the insurance industry is getting themselves into with this new situation said, don't go by the standard peer-reviewed journals. They're not real anymore. They're not applicable. So that's another factor I'm trying to deal with here.
Well, we can imagine that... let's say that there's two forces at work. I'm not saying that these are the only forces. I'm not saying that they're pure. But let's say that on the one hand, there's science, but real science. So science that questions itself, that has confirmed in genuine observation what it's talking about. And on the other hand, you have what could be called political science.
Yeah.
And all of the humanities and social sciences are political in a way. They're trying to bring forward a point of view that they claim has some sort of inherent value or is awake, right?
And well, they're trying to save their tradition, which is gone. And they're saying, no, we got to save what we did. We did do something worthwhile. We don't know what it is anymore, but we're fighting for it.
Well, I mean, sometimes they say that, but mostly they say that we're beyond all tradition. We're beyond any kind of collective wisdom. There's only what I assert or what people I like assert, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, let's imagine that there's these two forces. There's a force of what might be called real science, and then there's the force of pseudoscience, you could say. And certainly the humanities and the social sciences have been completely taken over by pseudoscience.
Yeah.
Now, we can, between these two forces, there's a ongoing conflict. And the conflict is that pseudoscience is trying to take over science.
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, it's done so. And maybe with COVID, for example, we don't have any real science going on because there's no transparency.
Yeah.
And science requires transparency. But on the other hand, real science challenges the stupidity of what's going on in the humanities and the social sciences. Real sciences says, let's make real things here. Let's really understand. And so you can see that there's, between these two forces, there's a conflict going back and forth that may end up with real science giving up the ghost and becoming just bullshit.
Yeah.
Or the bullshit, the existing bullshit of the humanities and social sciences may be exposed as bullshit. And we don't know how that play of forces is going to work out. All we know is that it's taking place.
And we know more and more. They tell us the public's more and more confused. They don't respect authority anymore because they're caught in that dilemma that you just
Correct.
Laid out.
And people can take advantage of that, right? When
yeah.
When a mob goes into a store and grabs everything, what's happening is that they're taking advantage of the fact that we don't know what's real anymore.
Right.
They're saying, well, the old categories like yours and mine don't apply.
And that's the because everybody's living in the texting world. Where everything's shared so quickly, nobody would consider ownership of it unless you get caught saying something and then the mob comes after you saying something that's incorrect, politically incorrect or spiritually
yep.
incorrect. Have you seen the World Economic Forum commercial or goal or platitude?
No, I saw that Ed put that up, but I didn't listen to it.
Yeah, well, basically they say... what I'm thinking
of. That was Klaus Schwab, right?
Yeah. And he says, yeah. They say, they have this young kid saying, I don't own anything, but I'm going to be happy, or I am happy. Or they say, you won't own anything, but you will be happy. I think that's the way it goes. You won't own
uh-huh.
anything, but you'll be happy. That's the world they're already living in. They don't live, you know, I see it every day on the beach. People are sitting there texting while in this wonderful environment. And that's all they're
yeah.
doing. It's
yeah,
like
yeah.
what they did. They said, okay, let's go on vacation. We'll go to Maui and tweet together, you know, sit beside each other. And they're all in their little things doing it. And
that's right. It's possible to think that they're ignoring the beauty of the sea and the sky and the sun and the moon and all that stuff. But actually, all of those things have been incorporated into their texting. So it's not that there's sort of a real world out there and they're numb to it or ignoring it or something. Rather, that whole world is incorporated in what they're texting, and the numb is between that whole world and other whole worlds.
Yeah, the texting on their screens is more beautiful than the nature around them.
Yeah, but it's not, as McLuhan would say, nature has died. So the nature has been incorporated into their texting. It's not that they don't see the sea and the sky and all that sort of stuff.
They see the new beauty. They see the new beauty in the texting.
Well, but they've it's not as if beauty is, you know, one thing. We can't just say they're seeing the beauty or something. what we can say is that this whole world, the physical world and the world of technology, everything, that is forms a kind of consolidated experience. And that consolidated experience is the cul-de-sac.
Yeah.
It's what people need desperately to get out of, but they cannot see any way to extricate themselves. Right? And what's interesting is when you were talking about Klaus Schwab saying, well, you're not going to own anything and you're going to be happy. Of course, the people that love that the best are the people that do own things, right?
Yeah.
So the Facebook people and the Twitter people and the Google people, all of those owners love to own things, right?
And they're miserable.
They're buying up most of Hawaii, for example.
Yeah, but they're miserable. At least their percent is miserable. They're harassed. They got to go explain themselves in Congress every few months, and they're not. So they own everything and not happy. Whereas this, the techno electro peasant,
they're involved. They're involved in this world that has no answers.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, and so that's not a very happy way to be, no matter how rich you are.
Yeah. So it attracts people who get happiness out of being unhappy. There's those kind of people.
Right. Well, that's at the end of the day, when people can't find ground, then they say not finding ground is ground.
Yes. Now, what's the meaning of supervene in your connubial article?
Well, I was trying to say that there's a dialectic of the above and below that's always going on. So
yeah, because I looked it up, and something you have something happening or an object, and then something goes past it. It supervenes it.
Yes. So I'm just going to go there right now.
Yeah.
And if we read the sentence, I think what we'll find is that I was using supervention in contrast to something like understand. So you have the under and the super, which is above and below.
Yeah, I see. All right. Okay, so that gives me a way to look at it. So, again, as we analyze my book, we end up analyzing your stuff. So
we haven't done very much of that, but that's a welcome development as far as I can see. Yeah, so I talk about underlies and supervenes, right? So you have the under and you have the over.
Okay. Yeah, that's maybe end with this. Ian says the word understanding is not appropriate because you're standing under something. Use the word overlaying. That's what we're really living. We're overlaying.
Right, and so, yeah, but I think Ian should say both.
Oh, yeah, he says both.
That
he
both said, are necessary.
Yeah, but he has to get people to realize there is another. And then they can reconcile the two, but they don't know. They think there's only one.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
So that's the whole way that NUM works, is that it consolidates into unity, and so NUM is a kind of defense against plurality.
Yeah, and there's a fine line between numbness and peace, capital P-E-A-C-E. To quote you.
Yeah, because remember that McLuhan, I'm in this post, I'm trying to explicate what connubial bliss is.
Yeah.
And connubial bliss is peace. And what is peace? Peace is the belonging together of the absolutely different.
Yeah.
So if you're a Catholic and you believe that God himself dies, absolute itself, that is to say God, that the absolute itself can die and become other than itself, is a very strange notion of peace. But it's, at the end of the day, it's the only notion of peace that works. If we don't recognize absolute difference, then at the end of the day, we're going to have to say, well, Russia or China or India or Thailand or whatever needs to become us.
Mm.
Number one, that's not going to work. Number two, it's very arrogant and just yields war instead of peace. So understanding the absolutely different is the first step towards peace. And I think that's what you were saying Ion was about.
Yes. And where does that old term, the other, come in here? We're always encountering.
Are you asking in my post or in my?
No, in just
opinion.
Now. You're talking about absolutely different, but I don't know what field, psychology or something. They talk about dealing with your other.
Correct. So
is that the same notion?
No. The other can appear in very different contexts. In thinking. So, for example, in Jungian psychology, analytic psychology, then the other is something internal, the shadow.
Mm.
And you have to come to terms with the internal other in order to understand how you act in the world.
Right.
But then the other appears in, Buber's thought, I and thou.
Yes.
Where understanding the claim of the other is the only way that the I can be authentic. So the other is a very rich theme in thinking, but it's not one theme. It's a whole bunch of themes.
Okay. Okay, so it's getting near your time to stop. So So in part two, I say McLuhan became famous for his phrase Global Village, but not so well known at the time was his phrase for the late 60s of global theater, which meant the satellite technology of the 60s had turned the global city into an art form. McLuhan, by the mid-60s, as can be seen in his correspondence with Sheila and Wilfred Watson, was perceiving a new environment of electronic process, the interplay of cliches and archetypes, the essence of consciousness. So that's the exciting point we've come to, and we'll see where the hell I take it. And,
sure.
And how you translate what I'm doing.
All right. Well, I translate what you just said there as the question of language.
Yeah.
Right? Language is the interplay of cliche and archetype and the essence of consciousness. So we could say that what McLuhan did is he thought he was the master of language until about 1950, and then going on from 1950, he realized he was the servant of language and had to figure out what that meant.
Yeah, and he writes to Pound right around that time in 1951, I think. He says, you guys had a new appreciation of the word, but I am dealing with a time where the word has become a drug.
Correct. Yep. Yep.
All right.
Good.
So,
well, that's a good place to leave it.
Yes.
It's a very thought-provoking perception.
These discussions are us having recess. Now we do the real work. You go off in your silence. I go off in mine for a couple of weeks, and we process whatever has to be processed, right?
That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, very good.
But I like, I got to tell you, Bob, I like very much how in our conversations you are presenting another face, I could say, right? You have the face of somebody who has thought through things that other people haven't.
Yes.
And that's sort of the adventurous Bob, the Bob that you need to understand and follow.
Yeah.
But I'd like to think that in our conversations, we're bringing out the probing Bob.
Yeah.
The Bob that is
the
going
ignorant
backwards
Bob.
In some sense.
The ignorant.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't
humble.
Use that phrase, but you can.
Right.
Remember
he said that Baudrillard had a weekly hebdomadary, was the word, session with his buddies, but he did it in great humility. That's what I do, talking to you, great humility. I don't show humility on the Jack Show on Instagram, if you've seen any of those. Right?
Yeah.
You're getting at that point.
Going up and going down.
Yeah, yeah. Well, glad you appreciate it. I am trying to be a reasonable person here.
Yeah, well, I think you're succeeding.
All right, very good. All right. Okay, so we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sir.
Great talking to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.